and welcome back to Franklin Covey's twice weekly podcast on Leadership with Scott Miller. That's me. I'm your host now. Coming into close to 7 years, we've taped nearly 400 episodes, released nearly 350 of them, where each week on Tuesdays and Fridays, I'm privileged to sit in this chair for the world's most trusted leadership firm, Franklin Covey, and interview people that have expert opinions on leadership, how to build a high-trust culture, how to be a better negotiator, a more effective communicator, a better parent, how to recover from a setback or a trauma, a broad variety of business titans, best-selling authors, researchers, people from all walks of life. Sometimes they are inside the Franklin Covey family, one of our thought leaders, curators, creators, or authors. And more times than not, there are people out in the industry who either wrote a book or did some research or had a triumph or in some cases a setback, and they have shown the vulnerability to agree to come on and talk about that so that you can be better at every role in your life. Dr. Covey, our co-founder, had a very prominent principle, which was he lived his life through the idea of an abundance mindset versus a scarcity mindset. And so we like to shine our spotlight on as many people as possible to make you better at whatever your unique mission is and whatever role or roles you are playing at this phase of your life. Today, our guest is an attorney. He's also a wildly popular author and really one of the world's experts at his craft. His name is Donald Passman, and he's authored this seminal book called All You Need to Know About the Music Business. This is the 11th edition. This book, published by Simon & Schuster, has sold coming up to close to 1 million copies. Now, you might be wondering, why are we interviewing an attorney about the music business? I have read most of this book. I'm not a musician. I'm certainly not a vocalist. I sing, kinda, chant, as a Catholic on Sundays at Mass. But I found so many great business principles in this book. We invited Donald to come on and talk today, because when any book sells almost 1 million copies, you know there is great insight in it to share. Plus, he's fun, he's witty, and his writing style is riotously engaging. Donald Passman, welcome to On Leadership.
Thank you, Scott. Nice to be here.
So, Donald, your book is a little bit of an outlier, as I mentioned, in terms of the general types of authors that we bring on to this podcast. We're not a book review podcast, but oftentimes curated creators, thought leaders have written books. Your book is in the 11th edition. Remarkable success. Congratulations on that from Simon & Schuster. Would you rewind a couple of decades and take a few minutes and walk our listeners and viewers through your career? How did you first get started? You went to Harvard Law School. Will you talk about how your career ended up either serendipitously or deliberately as arguably the world's foremost authority on negotiating the rights of music and being a wise counsel to anyone in the music business?
Okay, well, thank you, Scott. I did this on purpose, but I didn't know it was going to be on purpose until I got to law school. I always wanted to be a lawyer. My father was a lawyer, and I liked to argue and I liked logic. Meanwhile, I always loved music because I was always playing music. I was listening to music. My stepfather was a disc jockey in the day of personality jocks. So I was kind of around the music business. I played in a band when I was in college and law school, and I really enjoyed the process. But it was pretty clear that based on my talent level, it wasn't going to be a career for me. And I was planning to be a tax lawyer because I thought tax was actually fascinating, weird as that may sound to some. My second year of law school, they had a summer clerkship program, and one of the firms said entertainment law. And I thought, oh, what's that? I never knew there was such a thing. So after a little bit of a false start, I ended up going to an entertainment firm. I took a class at USC Law School on the music business, a class I later ended up teaching. And I thought, this is like fun. I'm wasting my time being a tax lawyer. So I changed firms and I went over to the firm I've been with ever since. And I absolutely passionately love what I do. It combines the things in my life that I love the most. It combines music, it combines law, it combines the intersection of commerce and art, which has always been a very difficult intersection. And I say that, and the example I use is a painting by Rembrandt called The Night Watch, which is one of the most famous paintings in the world. It's in the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. It takes up a whole wall. And the way you made a living in Rembrandt's time was you had a patron, and the patron paid for your art, and no patron, no, you starve. And so he was hired by the burghers of some city or other to paint their portraits. And when he painted it, some of them were in the foreground, some of them were in the background and smaller, some of their faces were in shadows. They were not pleased. In fact, he basically lost his career over it and was devastated. So I cite that as an example of how far back it goes to have a difference between art and commerce. And the reality is that if you're in the business, you can't make a living without art. But if you're an artist, you can't make a living without monetizing your art and without having business people help you. So we live together in this sort of Vulcan deathmatch.
Donald, will you take a few minutes and kind of recap over the course of your multi-decade career, what have been the big pivot points in music? You know, we think about, you know, vinyl and then CDs and now streaming, but I know it's more extensive than that. Can you just sort of opine extemporaneously over the last maybe generation or two or more, what have been the biggest disruptions and changes so we can kind of level set a conversation as we go into a lot of the business lessons?
Sure. Well, there was the change from vinyl to cassettes, which was fairly early on. It was relatively uneventful in the sense that they were both sold at retail and in record stores. CDs were a bit more disruptive because they were more expensive. They didn't fit into the bins in record stores, which caused people to have to retool and set things up differently. But the biggest issue that first came up, which was in the 90s, was piracy, starting in actually in the 1999 and rolling into the 2000s, because Napster came along and all of a sudden people could sell, could get their music for free. And it's pretty hard to compete with free if you're a record company. There were other things also. Record companies stopped selling single records. There used to be 45 RPMs and sometimes CD singles, but not seriously. Then they only sold albums. So people wanted one or two cuts. They were frustrated. They had to pay the full price of an album to get it. So the time and people perceived that records were overpriced. Sometimes you could buy a DVD of a movie for less than you could buy the soundtrack album, which didn't make any sense. So what happened was there was the consumers were, in a sense, revolting, and they were looking for a way to get what they wanted, which was single songs, the ones they wanted. They want to make their own playlists. They wanted to be able to listen to the music. So along comes Napster, offers it for free. And the record labels did something that's kind of a classic business school mindset. If you've read The Innovator's Dilemma, that book is exactly what happened in the music business, because when a new innovation comes along and threatens the status quo's tendency is to double down on what they have in the past. One of the examples in the book is Sears, who thought people wanted service, not Costco, where people wanted cheap prices in a warehouse. And so Sears doubled down on that and lost the market. In the music business, it was based on the fact that the retailers controlled 90-some-odd percent of the business, and they were very powerful, and the retailers did not want the record companies selling music digitally. And so they were taking a stand that if you do that, you're destroying our business. And the record companies, because it was so much of their business, were in this dilemma of how do we get through this? What happened was, of course, the retailers got devastated along the way. Something similar, by the way, happening right now to the theaters and the motion picture business, although a very different model. And so by doubling down on that, it was almost comical. And then they made the mistake of suing consumers, which was not exactly good press to sue some kid in Kansas who downloaded a song. And in retrospect, would have handled it differently, almost a picture of them standing there with the front door with a shotgun saying, you're not going to steal my music while everything's going out the back door through the piracy. So The idea was, and I, in my book, All You Need to Know About the Music Business, I actually predicted this in one of the editions, was that it, we would go to a music on demand, nobody called it streaming back then, model, because that's what people wanted. People wanted to be able to get the songs they wanted when they wanted it. They wanted to be able to share it with their friends. It was what the pirates were doing. And instead of stopping the piracy, which proved to be really difficult, expensive, and whack-a-mole, because as soon as you take one song down, another one pops up, then what we did is conscript the pirates. We created a similar experience. We didn't go directly there. It went first through Apple's download system, because the business was so devastated that Steve Jobs was able to say, you know, all your music flying out illegally, here you can get paid for it. And that became a major, if not main, source of the business for many years. Then when the technology for streaming caught up, because it wasn't there in the beginning, you couldn't deliver a good experience, then of course we moved to streaming. And that is by far the most profound change in the history of the business, which if you like, I can get into the reasons for that.
Donald, will you remind us in 2024, how does a musical artist make money? I mean, we know they have concerts and swag and things like that, but it's very different now than it was perhaps, you know, gosh, even 5, 10, 20 years ago. In 2024, how is a musical artist actually earning money?
Well, it of course depends to some degree on the artist. The artists that can tour successfully make a lot of money on it, and their record income tends to be not the biggest portion of their income. They also make money as songwriters if they're writing the songs, because those are also paid whenever you sell it, and they're paid for other people recording your music, not just your own recordings. So you can make money at that as well. They make money on endorsements. In the 60s, you know, no band would stoop to having their music associated crassly with a product, and then not that long ago, Led Zeppelin's on a Cadillac commercial, so you figure it out. The stigma on that is no more. So artists can make, not every artist will, some don't, but the ones that want to can make substantial monies from that as well. And then, as you pointed out, there's merchandise, swag, t-shirts, posters, things like that. And so those are the main sources of income.
Would you argue that, again, I know it's you know, artist by artist, but is the recording of a song really just sort of the loss leader? It's the marketing aspect for all the other ways to monetize that song, tours and endorsement deals and things like that?
It can be, but it can also, it's also a source of income. If you're a successful enough recording artist and you're streamed in sufficient numbers, you can still make good money doing that. It's just that it's not as big a proportion of your income for a really successful artist as it used to be.
I'm guessing the majority of us, maybe I'm dating myself, I mean, listen to music in the car. In fact, I don't think, I mean, obviously I listen to music on my iTunes account and on my phone in the gym, but, you know, historically and even still, the majority of my music I'm listening to on my commute in and out of the office or wherever I'm going. No one's getting paid to have their songs played on the radio, am I right? FM, AM, Sirius, any of that?
Sirius, they are getting paid. And by when you say no one's getting paid, the songwriters are getting paid. The people that wrote the songs get paid when the music on the radio. In the United States, people are not paid for terrestrial radio, meaning the over-the-air broadcast. They are paid for streaming radio, and they are paid for streaming services like Spotify. So depending on what you're listening to, if you're listening to an AM or FM station, then the artist isn't getting paid, but the songwriter is.
Well, talk to that point for a little more, too, because some songwriters are also vocalists, and some vocalists are songwriters, and there are some vocalists that don't write their songs. Again, I know it's circumstance-based, but give us a general idea of who's making the money and when, and is there a kind of a common rule of how often someone's writing their own songs? You hear so many times about, well, someone wrote this song, but somebody else sang it and made it popular, or this artist wrote the song, recorded it, it never took off, and then some other artist sung it and it took off, and who's getting paid there? Just tell us generally how that works. Is there a default scenario? Take that wherever you'd like to go.
I mean, there when the songwriter gets paid anytime somebody records their song and anytime it's performed publicly. So the songwriter is making money even if they don't know how to sing, as long as somebody else sings their song. The recording artist who sings the song is getting paid when their recording's exploited, whether it's streamed or put in a commercial or some other way that that it's monetized. But those are the main ways that people get paid for streaming or for radio.
Sounds like the business to be in is to be a songwriter. And then secondly, to be a songwriter who also is a vocalist. That's where the money is, by and large.
The second part, for sure. I mean, the songwriters don't get paid as much as the artists would get paid for that performance on the record, but they can be paid well. And that gap is narrowing a bit as we get into the streaming era, because the music publishers, the people who control the songwriters, are very much at the forefront of trying to get more money out of the pie.
I learned so much in your book about how this industry works, and there were so many interesting business ideas. By the way, Clayton Christensen was a member of Franklin Covey's board of directors for a long time prior to his passing a couple years ago, so we're big fans of his work, and he's a personal friend of our chairman. One of the insights I learned was the unintended disruption with artists when music moved from, records to streaming because of, what is it, high tides lift all boats or whatever it is. Can you talk about the principle of what happened to a lot of the revenue now that you could just buy individual songs versus going into a record store or buying, albums and happening upon other people's music?
Sure. Are you talking about downloads now, or are you talking about streaming, or both?
Well, I think probably downloads. The insight that I took from the book was that one of the downsides of, I guess, downloading is that, other artists weren't benefiting from you listening to or buying their song, right?
Right. That's actually more of an issue even in streaming than downloads. Downloads are pretty much going away. Weirdly enough, CDs are selling more than downloads these days. Nobody's quite sure why. My theory is that people that are sophisticated enough to download know how to stream, and people who buy CDs don't want to be bothered. But that's just my theory. Feel free to chime in with your own. But let me talk a bit about how streaming has radically changed the music business ecosystem. And this is really profound. Since the history of music business, this is by far the biggest tectonic shift we've ever had. So let me explain. From the very beginning of the music business, music was always sold by monetizing something. It might have been a piano roll, it might have been a wax cylinder, it might have been sheet music, but it was always something sold as a way of monetizing it. So once it's sold, the artist and the songwriter would get paid for that sale. And then after that, it didn't matter whether someone played it 1,000 times at home or never took it out of the shrink wrap and used it for a doorstop. The artist and the songwriter got the same amount of money. When you get to the streaming era, that's now completely different. Instead of being based on sales, it's now based on the number of streams. And let me explain for a minute how the streaming revenue works. So what happens is every month the streaming service pools together all their income. That would be advertising money, that would be subscription money, and they would put it into a pot. So let's say there's $1 million. Obviously, it's far more than that, but I'm just going to use money for an easy example. Let's suppose then they look at the number of streams that happened that month, and they sort it out by artist. So if you had 10% of the streams that month, 10% of that money, or $100,000, would go to you. Now, it doesn't go directly to you. Some of it goes to your record company, if you have one. And some of it will go to your publisher as well, which is the person who handles your songwriting stuff for the song itself. Remember, that's two separate rights. One is the artist and one is the songwriter, and they each get paid separately. They need not be the same person. So in our example, 10% goes allocated to you. Then they look at the record companies and who control or where the money goes. And and then they pay the money that's allocated to all the artists on that label to that record company. Then the record company takes that money. They look at how many streams you had that month compared to the number of streams that every other artist on their label had. And then you get that percentage allocated to you. And depending on your deal with the label, you get a split of that and you get whatever percentage of it you negotiate. That's the basics of it. But that brings up something that's not necessarily intuitive, and where here this is where the radical change comes from. In the past, if I had a big selling album, it would draw people into record stores, and there's a better chance you'll buy people will buy your album while they're there, because you can buy 2, 3, 4 CDs at a time. In a streaming age, however, you can only listen to one song at a time. And the allocation of the money is based on the number of listens. So for the first time, every listen that I get takes away money that you would get, and every listen you get takes away money that I would get, because we're dealing with a finite pool of money. In the sales days, in theory, there's not a finite pool. It's as big as the number of fans that want to buy it. But now there is. It's however much money the streaming service collected that month. And that's all that's going to get paid. How it gets whacked up, though, is based on who listens. So the competition now is for listens. It's not for sales. It's not, and that completely changed the way that music is marketed. It changed how people want to promote and know about it. The goal is to get you onto something we call lean back. There's two forms of listening on streaming. Lean in is where I'm going in and I want to find something new, and I'm looking for interesting artists, and I'm checking this out and checking that out. Lean back is I'm tired for the day, just entertain me, and I will put on either my playlist or someone else's. And you want to get on those people's playlists, because then when they're leaning back, you're making money because they're streaming your song. So the ecosystem is very, very, very different. In the heyday of CDs, the average consumer spent somewhere between $40 to $50 a month on CDs. In a streaming age, the average subscription is about $7 with student discounts, family discounts per month. So somebody's spending $84. Understand there's an inflation adjustment for that. But even so, we're ahead, and the potential for growth is substantial.
Donald, I have a very naive question to ask you. So recognize going into this, I admit this is pretty pedantic. Why are there such epic battles between artists and studios? I mean, I could name two or three that we know are very public, people who had to change their names or wouldn't refer to themselves or didn't tape music for a decade or retaped all their songs or had to, you know, basically kind of declare bankruptcy or sell their soul to stay in or stay out. It seems to me that the industry would have sort of level set on a level of trust and transparency and mutual respect that these recording houses, if you will, you know, whatever they are, and these artists would go into it eyes wide open. You'd be very clear that the studio, if you want to call it that, has the artist's best interest at heart. You see so many stories of boy bands and other artists that have these calamitous relationship breakdowns. Why? And why is it not changing? And why is it not cleaned up? It just seems so old school to me, when every corporate business that I know of is now all about transparency and trust and treating their vendors and stakeholders well for long-term success. It seems like those business principles like haven't hit the music business.
Well, they've hit it more than you might think. The stories you're talking about, a lot of them are from a number of years ago, because record labels used to tie up artists for a very long period of time under long-term contracts. And that may have been reasonable when the artist was nobody or just getting started, but with massive success, turned out to be not quite so reasonable. And yes, they get renegotiated, and the labels are good about that. But they could end up, certainly in the old days, having artists tied up for many, many, many years. Interestingly, it's changed radically in the last number of years, and it's changed for the following reason. The record companies now have data geeks that are combing the internet looking for any kind of music that's breaking out, starting to get traction, starting to attract fans, starting to stream and move and progressing. And then they all have the same data. So they're all chasing these artists once they start to get some kind of a breakout. And what that resulted in is that the new artists have bargaining power way beyond anything in history. Because they now have a quote track record before they were ever signed to a label. That never used to happen. So that means the new artists are making shorter deals. They're making better deals. They may end up actually owning their recordings, which was something reserved for superstars in the past, and licensing it to the company and getting the actual recordings back after a number of years, they may get a share of profits, also reserved for superstars in the older days. So they are becoming more transparent. They are becoming better deals along the way. But going back to my Rembrandt example, there's always going to be differences between artists and the record labels who are their patrons in this example, because that's the nature of it. Particularly if things aren't going right, they can get upset with each other. Or if things are going really well and they're still tied up for a long period of time, or there's all kinds of things they can fight about. The record deals have a lot of exclusivity, and that may get in the way of something the artist wants to do. So there's always some kind of a squabble, but the playing field has gotten much, much better than it was back in the days of Prince riding Slave on his face.
I warned you it was a naive question. Thank you for letting me down gently on that one. Hey, a big portion of your book you call part one is your team of advisors. Who doesn't need this principle in their life? You actually call it how to pick a team. And you generally say there is five components of your team: your personal manager, your attorney, your business manager, your agency, and then your groupies. And you acknowledge you can't help them on their groupies. Good luck with that. But would you take a few minutes and walk us through the first four components and how they're different: personal manager, attorney, business manager, and agency?
Sure. The personal manager is the COO of the enterprise. That's the person that everything filters through on the business and often the creative side as well. They really are the one running your enterprise. And so they're, in that sense, probably the most important person on your team because they've got to be the generalist. They've got to shield you from the world. They've got to help you with strategic decisions. And so they're very, very important. And they need to understand all the aspects of the business in order to be able to do that. The lawyers, of course, are the second most important. That's my joke. But the lawyers in the music business are very much involved in a lot of deals across all areas. So unlike other areas, the lawyers, we actually have expertise. We have relationships with labels. We have relationships with managers, agents, most everyone in the business. And we have a lot more information. Managers, by nature of their work, unless they're a huge management company, can't do that as many clients as lawyers can because our time is not as intense for each client as it is for a manager. So in that situation, the lawyers have a lot of information. We know a lot of deals. We know who's doing what. We know who likes to do what. And we're very much involved in the process. The business manager handles the money. They're often the last person on board because they're expensive. And legitimately so. They have a staff. They have to be able to service people. And until you're making a certain amount of money, it may not be worth it. You can get by with an accountant to do your taxes and keep track of things. But as soon as you get really successful, they also have a lot of information because they do a lot of tours. They do a lot of deals. They're very well versed financially. So they're in charge of your financial life. They will help you find advisors for your investments. They will help you manage yourself so that you come out of it in the days if things start to fade, that you're set up for life. And then the agents are very important, but they're limited for the most part to touring and sometimes to endorsements in this business. Unlike the film business, where they're across all the major aspects, here they're mostly involved in live touring and to some degree, and with some artists, involved in endorsements as well.
Donald, this episode won't appeal to every one of our millions and listeners and viewers around the world, but I do think it will appeal to someone also in their life, whether it's a daughter or a son or a cousin or a nephew. Everybody knows someone who's a budding vocalist and artist. Will you talk to all those people that have someone in their life they're not quite sure how to get started? They can sing and they want to make a career out of it. Can you explain, do you need a record label? Do you do it yourself? Like in 2024, what's a pretty centralized path where someone could get started? And what questions and answers should they be asking and finding solutions to?
Really good question, Scott. Actually, one of the reasons I wrote All You Need to Know About the Music Business is because I got asked a lot of people that wanted to understand the business and just didn't know how to get started. It's different today than when I put out the first edition of the book in a long way. And it's kind of what I alluded to earlier. you need to do a lot of it yourself. And there's some pretty good DIY books out there on how to do that. I recommend one by Amy Thompson in my book, and it's free online. But basically, you need to build a following. You need to get on the internet, and you need to build fans. If you perform live, that's a good way to get started as well. And then there's a whole bunch of tips in the book about how to do that, although it's not a DIY book. That's just a section of it. So that's the first step, whether you want to get signed to a label, as many do, or whether you want to go it by yourself. That's also a section I discuss it. The criteria there is basically, who do you want to be? If you're a niche kind of obscure music and you have a very dedicated but small fan base, you're probably better off doing it yourself. You'll make more money. You won't have to pay the record company a piece of it. If you want to be a worldwide international superstar, so far, the people who've done it have had labels behind them. They may get very far before they go to the label and be able to make an excellent deal. But they've had some kind of label involvement to get it there, because the labels have a lot of data. They have boots on the ground around the world. They have expertise. They can be helpful when you get to that stage.
This, again, probably is a naive question, but I would love to know, where does the money go? So I'm guessing you can still download a song on iTunes or something for 99 cents. We have a subscription in our house, but I'm guessing you can still download individual songs and pay for them, right?
Yes.
Okay. You can. So let's just go with that theory. Let's just say, and I apologize to all of our younger viewers that think I'm a dinosaur, haven't downloaded an individual song in 10 years. And I just see the Apple bill. Actually, I don't even see the bill because it's so big. My wife hides me from it. But let's just say there's a dollar download. Where does all that money go? I'm guessing the artist, the recording, the vocalist gets the smallest percent, but maybe use that as an example. If you have 99 cents to work with, where is it generally all going out?
Okay. Well, 30% of it goes to Apple. That's their platform fee. So about 70 cents goes back to the record label. And out of that 70 cents, they're going to pay the songwriter for that, about 14 cents. The rest of it is then becomes their but then based on the 70 cents, they're going to pay the artist whatever royalty they negotiated. So if they had a 20% royalty, they would get 14 cents.
And then from that 14 cents, the artist is paying their manager and their attorney and everybody else out of that money, in essence.
Yeah, that's right. And if there's a producer on the record, the producer may get a piece of that. If there's a guest artist, they would get a piece of it. And then whatever's left over after all that. And also the record label charges back recording costs and advances. So once you earn that, if you haven't earned back from your 14 cents in our example, if you haven't earned back your full advance, then they don't pay you anything until you do. Once you do, then you start getting paid, and your manager and so forth get paid on that.
Donald, I'm going to guess that some portion of the nearly million people that have bought this book are like me, that aren't in the music business, but they just found it so valuable in terms of negotiation and licensing and all the questions to ask. Well, you just spend the last couple of minutes kind of free forming. What are some of the general business principles in this book that you think creators and artists, not specific to the music business, should be thinking about as you're watching your industry and others evolve and change, what AI is doing, what TikTok and the metaverse, all the changing various levels of our life are looking like? What are some questions and principles people should be thinking about in their own businesses?
Okay. Well, the music business has been the canary in the coal mine for a lot of technology changes. We were our piracy was way ahead of the film business piracy, because it, at the time it was too cumbersome to download a film, and nobody wants just part of a film, whereas people did want one song. So we're ahead of the curve on a lot of different things. And ahead of curve on the positive side with the streaming, which has been substantial. And so I think the principles are that you want to understand where it's going. You want to maximize your involvement with it. I mean, I think It's the same as any other business. You need to be sensible about what you're doing. You need to look at your costs. You need to look at your expenses. I talk about artists being a business. Most of them aren't interested in business, but they need to understand the basic principle, because nobody takes as good a care of your business as you do. They don't have the same stake in it, understandably. So to the extent that people are watching it themselves, they need to pay attention. And particularly with creative artists, and I guess this applies to any product with a limited life cycle, you need to be realistic about the fact that this streamline of earnings may not go on forever. It might, and then you'll be happily surprised, but I like to plan as if it's not going to. It's just like any other piece of business. You need to have a budget. You need to understand your income and your earnings. You need to put some money aside for investment, because if you just sort of wait to see what's left over, there may not be any. And it's really important that you take care of your business.
Donald, what's the biggest mistake, regret, that artists have that had they known this going into it, they may have been able to negotiate their deal, but they were so grateful, they were so honored, they were caught up in the early wave that they just signed because they were so excited. Are there one or two like really valuable principles that guardians and parents and friends should be reminding their future star, a vocalist about?
Yes, there absolutely are. The biggest mistake I see is people who've signed a very long-term deal with someone and no ability to get out of it without any success. That tends to be more like a manager who got in early and signed them to a long-term deal and then wants to hang on to a percentage of them, even if they're not capable of helping the artist the way that they promised they would. I think also it's important to check out the people you're dealing with. I have a whole section in All You Need to Know About the Music Business on checking references, how to figure out who you're talking to, and using your instinct. If you think you're talking to someone slimy, you probably are. If you think you're talking to someone really slick who sounds great, check them out anyway. Some of the worst thieves are under this shiny veneer. So it's really about being cautious who you get in business with. And it's also about making sure that the deal, for example, with a manager, you could set it up that if you haven't earned a certain dollar amount within a couple of years, you can get out of the deal. Otherwise, you might find yourself tied up for a long time. You're very successful. They have little or nothing to do with it, and they're just getting a percentage.
Last question, which is the flip side of that question. I want you to think about maybe not the most successful recording artist in history, but someone either you've worked with or you know of. What did they do well beyond their talent? Like, what did they do well that could be replicated by others now that you're going to share it with us?
Yes. It was something I actually made a study of early in my career, because I was fascinated with what made people really successful, actually in any business. And I think the one denominator is an absolute determination that they're going to make it no matter what gets thrown in the way of obstacles. I mean, there are artists that were that spent years developing before they were overnight sensations. And so in a day when you can order your latte with half foam and a shot of vanilla, people expect to get things exactly the way they want them right away. But it doesn't always work like that. And in fact, if it does, sometimes that's a detriment. You get there. In other words, you have a big success and you haven't built up the skills and the long-term work that you need to do to sustain it. So I think that the main thing is passion, drive, and also the superstars know exactly who they are. They want to be true to their image. They're not just selling out to anything that throws money at them. They've got a vision, and they've got persistence, and they've got the drive to see it through no matter what the cost.
I lied. One more question. You sometimes hear this conflict between an artist and his or her recording company, her label, and the label wants them to sing this kind of music or do this, and they want to do this, and then they end up fighting or divorcing or selling out or whatever it is. Again, I know that it's circumstantial, but how much credibility would you put in the instinct of the artist versus and listening to the label with their data scientist and all their understanding of consumer preferences and where it's going. Is it a nice balance? Would you say 9 times out of 10, the artist was right, or their ego and their hubris got the best of them and they should have listened to the experts at the label? Where would you take that?
Well, I've seen all of the above. I've seen artists that absolutely hated a song that was the biggest hit of their career. And I've seen companies try to force a song on an artist that was a complete dud and probably hurt their career. That's where the personal manager, particularly if it's a creative manager, gets involved. They will have opinions on this, and they will mediate between the two of them, and they will help get to a place where everybody's a bit compromised. And a sign of a compromise is nobody's 100% happy. But that's where the manager would navigate through it.
Donald Passman, Harvard Law School trained attorney, frequently cited as one of the most influential, wisest sages in the entertainment industry. Your book is All You Need to Know About the Music Business: Why Artists Have More Power Than Ever in History, Artificial Intelligence, TikTok, and the Metaverse Impact on Music, the Mega Million Dollar Sales of Artist Songs and Record Catalogs, with Updated Numbers, Trends on the Business, the 11th edition. Donald, thanks for joining us today. Fascinating conversation.
Thank you, Scott.
And we'll see you back here next week for a new conversation on music. I mean leadership.